This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
We all face two basic questions in our lives. How can I be good? The second, how can I be happy? And as we begin to explore these questions, they immediately give rise to a third, which is, how does the first relate to the second? And are they compatible? Or are they in competition with one another? We could do a very long ongoing graduate seminar in the history of philosophy and religion and psychology and ethics, looking at how throughout history, in various times and various cultures, people have gone about answering those two questions, and particularly how they go about understanding the relationship between goodness and happiness. People typically start with one and then try to adapt to the other. Plato started with an investigation of the good. Aristotle was unusual, and he started with an investigation of the nature of happiness. Most religions are defined by their conception of the good. Certainly, Western religion, the good is identified with following God's commandments in one form or another, and very often these commandments are at odds with our ordinary daily notions of happiness, if we equate it with our pleasure, particularly our sexual pleasure, but in general all sorts of ways in which goodness is defined in terms of prohibitions. In fact, you might say one of the main reasons people think up the idea of heaven is that there's such an apparent disjunction between doing good and being happy that we have to create an afterlife in which things are going to finally get balanced out. Now, it's very possible to go to extremes if you privilege either goodness or happiness at the expense of the other. Typically, we think of goodness as reining in our desires, as if our happiness is going to, if unchecked, lead us to want to get and grab as much as possible, often at the expense of our neighbor. And it certainly easy to see that the unchecked pursuit of happiness in forms of pleasure or possession can lead to greed and selfishness and dominance and all sorts of things. And we can easily see the ways in which we can become a monster in the service of the unchecked pursuit of stuff. But we have to be equally cautious of that we don't become monsters in the pursuit of goodness. There's certainly the version of goodness gone awry that we can see in things like the Inquisition, where we become so certain of our own notion of goodness that we feel justified in doing anything to anyone who doesn't share it. But there are also much more subtle versions, ways we can become monsters of goodness. And I would say that for our purposes, they are ways in which the whole question of our own personal happiness or even our own personal needs become delegitimized in the service of goodness, or in our case, practice. And I've encountered quite a few people who grew up in either very religious or very political or very socially conscious households, where the message they got very early on was that wanting things for themselves was selfishness, and that the only legitimate desire one could have was to help others. And I think this is a kind of perversion of goodness that permeates a great deal of religious practice and leads to what I've called the perversion of vowing to save all beings minus one. We have no notion of the legitimacy of our own needs and can only serve the needs of others. I've written about how I think even Joko was someone who often taught in that kind of manner when she talked about love as something that is given totally and unconditionally without expecting anything in return. This leads to people who are quite capable of giving love but who deny that they ever need it. This imbalance rarely works out very well and becomes either masochistic or prune-like, one way or the other. So how about our practice in Buddhism? As much as I would like to do a magical mystery tour of the entire Western philosophical history here, probably should talk a little bit about Buddhism. Buddhism, of course, does not directly address the idea of happiness. It starts at the opposite end with the problem of suffering. And the problem of suffering, basically, we can say, comes from the pursuit of happiness in Buddhism. The problem being that happiness, as we usually think about it, is predicated on having and holding on to something, whether we think of it as an internal state of mind, getting into a certain state of calmness, equanimity, or if you want to be fancy, enlightenment, some internal condition and staying there, or getting some stable form of life where you can feel happy and secure. And Buddhism's basic message is that both of those projects are doomed to failure, and that the attempt to create or hold on to anything must fail, because all dharmas, all things are intrinsically empty or impermanent. And that suffering is precisely the attempt to control or hold on to the uncontrollable and the impermanent. Now, this basically creates a model that says you need to stop doing these compulsive, grabby, clingy kind of things, right? And let things go. And that there is no direct pursuit of hope getting of happiness in there, but there is a relief of an endlessly failing project. Right? And the original precepts for the Buddhist community were organized around this idea that we should live our lives in accordance with this realization of impermanence, having no fixed possessions, no fixed personal relationships, and no even fixed abode. The community is of homeless mendicant monks. I've often said this is based on the principle that if you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. So it doesn't speak very directly about happiness. But what's interesting in a certain way to our discussion is that the end of suffering there creates as its byproduct an ethics, because our ethical dilemmas are presumed to arise from our failure to realize the impermanent nature of things. And so that our ethical dilemmas arise out of one form or another of grasping, of imagining things are separate and permanent, and that I can get a hold of my pile at the expense of you, your pile. So that in an interesting way, the ethics grows out of that kind of realization of emptiness and mutual interdependence and karma. Now, I personally think that we are not really here simply to end suffering. Right? I think that we are, all of us, actively attempting one way or another to be happy. And happiness is not going to be just a matter of stop beating your head against the wall. We want it to have a positive quality, not simply the absence of something, right? I modified our meal chants recently with that in mind, where we previously used to say, fourth, to support our life, we take this food, right? Food being instrumental and utilitarian, if not medicinal, in that kind of model. So I changed that to fourth, to enjoy our life, we take this food, right? We should take pleasure in it. And the taking pleasure in it is not a guilty, sneaky pleasure, but it is in some way very basic to what we're doing. We want to have our practice, in some very deep sense, be a flavor enhancer. right? That we want practice to generate things like delight and appreciation and gratitude, deep enjoyment about our life and how it is and the way the world is, right? Joko's idea of practice, in a sense, was geared to just noticing moment after moment how we don't do any of those things. Basically, she said that moment after moment, we're essentially saying to ourselves, this isn't it, this isn't it, this isn't it, you know. My nose itches, you know, my knee hurts, my mind is wandering, the room is too hot, person next to me smells a little bit. Whatever it is, that there's a kind of complaint about life that is sort of the constant stream of our existence, right? And so her idea of practice, in a sense, was to notice moment after moment that sense of rejection and resistance. Right? And the important move is that we're not attempting to stop doing those things, but to make those moments themselves it. That's our life. My nose itches, my knee hurts, I'm thinking too much. All these thoughts, feelings, they're just stuff. There's just the moment, right? There's nothing wrong with any of it, right? We want our practice to, in a certain sense, to make all these things that we normally think of as intrusions or problems to be the very flowers of life. The way Philip Larkin said that depression is for me what daffodils was for Wordsworth. we need to take the negatives, so-called negatives in our life, and turn it into the very object of our attention and appreciation. Right? And I do think that we want this to end up with a positive valence at the end. You know, it's not, it is not as if we are aiming for a great and final neutrality about everything as we sit. And we're certainly not sitting, I hope, to cultivate a kind of toughness or indifference where we just train ourselves to sit through anything, no matter how painful or boring. There has to be, at the end of the day, some sense that we're doing this because we enjoy it. I hope we can enjoy our practice and our lives together.